welcome to the reading of the Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 29th. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Okay, so let's take a look at the Telegraph Herald here, and just a quick thing about the weather. It's chilly today, isn't it? Chillier than I think a lot of people expected. And we're going to have a high of 38 today and a low of 22 tonight. And there's just a slight possibility of some snow showers, but nothing to be concerned about. All right, let's take a look here. Iowa bill bolsters robotics in schools. Local educators say that students gain valuable experience participating in the programs. Over the past 4 years, Michael Walkel has wondered whether some of the lessons he's learned in the classrooms of Dubuque Senior High School are truly applicable in the real world. But when he joined the Dubuque Community School District's high school robotics team, he found himself using geometry to perfect the length of a robotic arm, or physics to calculate the torque of gears on the machine that he and his teammates constructed for competitions each year. His interest in science and technology and engineering and mathematics, also better known as STEM, subjects was piqued, and Michael enrolled in matching and computer science classes at senior. After he graduated in June, he plans to study computer science in college. Robotics has given him the opportunity to explore and use what I've been taught in class, as well as learning a lot of new skills, he says. A bill that recently passed the Iowa Senate would bolster state recognition of and funding for high school robotics teams, such as Dubuque's. Local students and coaches say that the proposed legislation is an important step toward expanding robotics and launching it in schools that do not currently offer a team. These studies are getting a chance to practice their future careers. These students are getting a chance to practice their future careers in a safe setting, said robotics team coach Ann Arnold, who teaches math in the Dubuque District's Alta Vista campus. They're learning to communicate with adults and meet deadlines and work in high-pressure situations. We need to get as many students to participate in robotics as we can, just to give them a head start after high school. Dubuque Community School's high school robotics team, which competes in FIRST Robotic Challenges competitions, currently has 31 members who attend both senior and Hempstead High Schools. The team has grown in recent years, particularly through strong incoming classes. 13 freshmen joined the team this year, according to senior sophomore Ella Meyer. Okay, what else is going on here? In the Dubuque area, new Dubuque Bank planning to open doors next week. 15 former employees of DB&T and HTLF join Tut Fuller at Capra Bank. A new local financial institution is set to begin operations next week, and a team of established Dubuque banking officials will start new positions at the bank. The Dubuque branch of Capra Bank, which will also be Capra's bank headquarters, will open on Monday, April 3rd at 955 Washington Street in the former Dubuque Food Co-op space. The full-service branch comes after Tut Fuller, who will serve as the bank's CEO and chairman, acquired a bank in Montezuma, Iowa last year with his brother Thomas J. Fuller, who will serve on the bank's board. "We think great clients deserve great bankers," Tut Fuller said. "We think great bankers deserve a great bank, and our version of banking, Capra's version of banking, is a relationship-based bank, and you need great bankers to do just that." Last week, 15 individuals resigned from their positions at Dubuque Bank and Trust and HTLF, the holding company for DB&T. "We have always had a client and community-centric vision since we decided to start out on this adventure, Fuller said of Capra Bank, to do the best things for your clients and your community. And you can have great banks that are empowered and work together as a team that can actually make a great decisions. And I couldn't be more excited to bring that to Dubuque in my hometown. Okay, let's see what else is going on here in Dubuque. Dubuque adding 22 full-time positions. Van Milligan says that several of the roles were created to address administrative workloads. The number of approved Dubuque City staff positions is increasing by the net equivalent of 17.29 full-time city employees with its most recently approved budget. While the overall number of approved part-time positions is decreasing by the equivalent of 4.49 full-time positions, and seasonal positions will decrease by 0.22, the city's budget for fiscal year 2024, which begins on July 1st, will see a net increase of the equivalent of 22 full-time positions over the previous fiscal year, bringing the city's total staff to the equivalent of 769.01 full-time positions. Some of those positions were previously created by the city through budget amendments during current fiscal year, while others are part-time positions that are being upgraded to full-time in order to make them more attractive for prospective employees. All right. Well, let's turn the page here. Let's see, what else do we have here? Okay, we're going to go to the Dubuque and tri-state area of the paper. News in brief, rally to support transgender students, see set for Friday. A rally in support of transgender youth will take place on Friday in Dubuque and will now be held indoors due to expected inclement weather. The Protect Trans Kids rally will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday, March 31st at Smokestack. At 62 East 7th Street. It was previously slated to take place outdoors at Dubuque County Courthouse and Washington Square, but the increasing certainty of storms prompted organizers to move it inside, according to an online announcement. The event will feature presentations from speakers and artists in support of transgender individuals and in honor of International Transgender Day of Visibility, celebrated annually on the 31st of March, according to the announcement. Iowa has taken a leap backwards in human rights and parenting autonomy, targeting LGBTQIA plus youth who are already vulnerable, the announcement also goes on to say. Two laws signed by Governor Kim Reynolds last week ban transgender people from using school bathrooms of their identified gender and ban doctors from prescribing puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones for minors. Okay, let's see what else do we have here in news briefs. We've got the police, man sexually assaulted woman at knife point. Police said a man sexually assaulted a woman at knife point last month in Dubuque. John M. Schmidt, age 46, no permanent address, was arrested at 4 p.m. Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging second-degree sexual abuse. Court documents state that Schmidt sexually assaulted a 24-year-old woman while holding a box-cutter-style knife to her throat February 18th, while parked in a vehicle at Mines of Spain State Recreation Area. The man then drove the woman to downtown Dubuque, dropped her off. She walked to Dubuque Law Enforcement Center to meet with police officers. Police used traffic camera footage to track Schmidt's vehicle, driving along Julian Dubuque Drive towards the Mines of Spain at approximately 1:51 a.m. on the 18th of February, and leaving the area of Julian Dubuque Drive approximately an hour later. All right, let's see what else do we have here going on. Police say that two hurt in two-vehicle crash in Dubuque. Police did say that two people were injured in a two-vehicle crash on Monday in Dubuque and M. Schreier, age 34, and infant passenger Owen T. Schreier, both of Dubuque, were transported by ambulance to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital for treatment of their injuries, according to Dubuque police. Police said that a vehicle driven by Michael A.C. Wagner, age 35, of Maquoketa, Iowa, was traveling east on Asbury Road at 8:03 a.m. and failed to stop at the red light at the intersection with Northwest Arterial. Wagner's vehicle broadsided the Schreier vehicle, which was traveling north on Northwest Arterial. Wagner was cited with failure to respond to steady red light and failure to provide proof of financial liability. Okay, well, there's a big picture. There's a picture here. It says course direction, and it shows someone doing some snow plowing. It says a worker and a snow groomer pushes snow into place Tuesday to form the track for Thiessen's Snowcross National at Sundown Mountain Resort west of Dubuque. The event is scheduled for Saturday and Sunday, the 1st of April and 2nd. It's a big picture. A lot of snow there. Okay. Hospital updates DRA on workforce program. Unity Point Findlay Health Foundation received a $48,600 grant for Senior Student Promise Program. Officials from a Dubuque hospital provided an update on its program aimed at offering support to students and in aiding recruitment and retention of the hospital's workforce. Findlay Health Foundation officials gave a presentation to board members of the Dubuque Racing Association at DRA's monthly meeting Tuesday at Q Casino. In July, the DRA awarded Unity Point Health Findlay Health Foundation a $48,600 core grant for its Senior Student Promise Program, which provides funds, to qualified senior health science students in exchange for a two-year commitment working at Findlay Hospital. Retention of highly skilled healthcare professionals benefits patients and families and has a positive impact on the Dubuque community, said Barb Potts, executive director of the Findlay Health Foundation. We believe these students will come for a job and stay for a career with Findlay Hospital. Potts also said that the Senior Student Promise Program began in July of 2022. Students who qualify can receive up to $20,000 for certain educational expenses, such as tuition, supplies, books, uniforms, or living stipends. Upon graduating and seeking work at Findlay, the participating students can apply to various jobs from nurses to lab technicians. Chad Wolbers, who's Findlay's president and CEO, told the DRA board that the hospital is still experiencing workforce challenges following the pandemic. Although the pandemic may seem to some to be in the rearview mirror, we're very much still in the throes of a crisis when it relates to workforce. In our worst day during COVID, we had 130 open positions in the organization. I'm pleased to report we are down to 70, which is where we were around pre-COVID. To date, Potts and Findlay Health Foundation has committed $83,000 to six students participating in the Senior Student Promise Program. In addition, five students have signed a letter of intent to work with Findlay after their upcoming graduation, resulting in another estimated $100,000 in investment. In Galena, the $34.5 million upgrade will add 46,000 square feet. In Galena, officials with the Galena Hospital plan to soon begin construction on a major expansion project, including the addition of turning lanes for which city leaders recently approved a financial agreement. Midwest Medical Center in September unveiled plans for the 34.5 million expansion, which will add about 46,000 square feet and renovate existing spaces, including a new main entrance. In tandem with the entrance, the hospital plans to complete a separate project, widening US 20 and adding turning lanes into the hospital. City Council members on Monday approved an escrow agreement with Midwest Medical Center for the turning lanes, in which Midwest Medical Center will place $2.1 million in an account at First Community Bank of Galena. The amount covers the $1.8 million in construction costs and a factor to account for prevailing wage in the unlikely event that the city's forced to access the escrow and complete the turning lane project, according to City Administrator Mark Moran. Our escrow agreement is essentially a guarantee that the turning lane project will be completed prior to the opening of the addition, Moran goes on to say. We have no reason to believe that the hospital will not complete it, but the escrow agreement was one of the conditions set by the Zoning Board of Appeals when they approved the hospital's additional proposal. All right, now we turn to the opinion page. And every week we have different people contributing an op-ed, an opinion editorial here on the page. Let's take a look at this one written by Bob Ritz and Huando Caron. And this is about thanking a doctor on this Doctor's Day. The healthcare landscape has changed fundamentally in the past 3 years. Facing the COVID-19 pandemic was an extraordinary challenge, and our team rose to the occasion without hesitation. Now, we are all dealing with the financial and staffing challenges from a 2-year battle with COVID. This period is referred to as the aftershock. Through it all, one thing remains the same. Our doctors help each person live their best life. Whether it's an in-person visit or a telehealth appointment, a routine physical, or something more urgent, doctors are there to ensure that you get the answers you need. And today they deserve our thank you. Every year we honor and celebrate doctors on the 30th of March, Doctor's Day. Doctor's Day was first observed in 1933 and was championed by Eduardo Brown Ullman, the wife of a doctor in Georgia, who felt that physicians should receive more recognition for their important work. She sent greeting cards to all the local physicians and their wives and placed red carnations on the graves of deceased doctors, which has become the representative flower for the day. Today, the tradition of saying thank you to doctors in late March continues. So, what can you do to express your gratitude for a doctor? Well, the traditional thank you note, whether a physical card or an email, goes a long way to deliver your thanks. Donating to a local medical center foundation or nominating your doctor for an award are additional ways to show gratitude. But there are other ways to show your appreciation. Your doctors want you to be healthy. Making and keeping your routine appointments is a great way to show your gratitude to your physicians. And it benefits you as well as routine physicals and checkups on known health conditions helps your doctor to assess your well-being over time and allow for small adjustments to routines or medicine or medications along the way. Following your doctor's advice is another way you can show you care. Get that prescription filled, start the exercise routine, stop smoking, whatever it may be, your doctor's always here to help you live your best life. Be sure to continue scheduling appointments for immunizations as they are due. For example, schedule flu vaccines and COVID-19 boosters annually. Arrange for a tetanus booster every 10 years. Don't take this technology for granted. Immunizations and boosters are critical to overall community health. Even the small gesture of gratitude can be extremely rewarding, as it will help your physician maintain perspective about why they dedicated their lives and energy in mastering their field of expertise. Doctors play an important role in our lives. Across Mercy One, we're so proud of their unwavering commitment to our patients. On this Doctor's Day, our 24,000 Mercy One colleagues extend our heartfelt appreciation to each one of our 2,000-plus doctors for the caring and compassionate way they help each person live their best life. Please join us this Doctor's Day, Thursday, March 30th, to say thank you to doctors. It will also go a long way to let them know that we want them to have a special day. Well, that's a good article. And they are very important for all of us, are they not? All right, what else is going on here in the paper? We're going to move now to the tri-state area of the paper. Murder suspect to argue he acted in self-defense. Aaron C. Johnson is accused of fatally shooting Lonnie E. Burns multiple times on the 7th of February in Dubuque. A man accused of fatally shooting another man in Dubuque will argue that he acted in self-defense. Aaron C. Johnson, age 24, of Chicago, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. He has pleaded not guilty, and his trial date is currently set for the 9th of May. According to court documents recently filed by Johnson's attorney, Les Blair Johnson intends to rely on the defenses of self-defense and her justification at the time of trial. Johnson is accused of fatally shooting Lonnie E. Burns, age 31, on February 7th. Court documents state that the police received a report of a shooting and a person on the ground in the 700 block of Romberg Avenue at about 12:45 a.m. that day. Officers who arrived on the scene found Burns unresponsive and lying in a yard between 7:11 and 7:15 Romberg Avenue, and he was pronounced dead at a local hospital. During the autopsy, the medical examiner was able to determine that Burns was shot twice in his left arm, which penetrated his torso. Documents state he suffered an additional gunshot to his back. Documents state that the traffic camera footage shows six people getting out of a vehicle parked in the 700 block of Lincoln Avenue on the 7th of February, walking to a 7-Eleven Romberg, or I should say walking to 7-Eleven Romberg Avenue. A confrontation with Burns then began on the sidewalk. One individual approached Burns with a gun and displayed it, and the two began to wrestle. The subject then fires a gun at Burns, document states. Burns attempted to flee the area, and the subject continues to shoot at Burns. Johnson was identified as the shooter through multiple interviews with others present during the shooting, as well as a traffic camera footage, according to court documents. Man pleads guilty to child pornography. Sentencing hearing is set on the 22nd of May for Gian H. Sanagusan, who could face 9 years in prison. A man has pleaded guilty to 13 charges related to Dubuque investigation into child pornography found on his devices. Gian H. Sanagusan, age 44, recently pleaded guilty in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to 5 counts of promotion of child sex abuse material, 5 counts of possession of child sex abuse material, and 3 counts of identity theft. His sentencing hearing is set for the 22nd of May. If a plea deal is accepted, 5 additional counts of promotion of child sex abuse material and 5 additional counts of possession of child sexual abuse material could or would be dismissed. Plea documents state that 9 years in prison will be the recommended sentence. Court documents state that the Google officials reported to National Center of Missing and Exploited Children on the 12th of June in 2019 that child pornography was being uploaded from two email addresses and two cell phone numbers associated with San Guslin. The associated IP address was traced back to Dubuque Hotel, or should I say to a Dubuque Hotel. A search warrant on San Guslin's device revealed numerous images and videos of nude males engaged to be under the age of 18 engaging in sex acts. Documents state emails from Tumblr, a social media site, indicated that San Guslin uploaded sexually explicit videos that were against Tumblr's policy, and that he used the account of solicit, receive, and decimate children pornography, at least as far back as 2017. Investigators found numerous images and videos associated with a social media account linked to San Guslin. Southwest Wisconsin political activists are preparing for consequential election. State Supreme Court seat will tip the balance of power on abortion congressional maps. County-level political parties in Southwest Wisconsin are knocking on doors and distributing signs ahead of the Tuesday, April 4th election for Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice, a technically nonpartisan race in which both candidates align with one party's values or the other. The winner is expected to be the ideological tiebreaker on the 7-member court when deciding divisive issues. The winner will replace conservative Justice Patience Rogensack, who is retiring. The other members of the state Supreme Court are split ideologically, with three liberal and three conservative-leaning justices. In particular, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is expected to decide the fate of the state's 1849 abortion ban, in place since Roe v. Wade was overturned, and the state's legislative district map, which has been gerrymandering to favor a Republicans since 2011. Dave Serta is president of the Republican Party of Lafayette County, whose members are backing conservative-leaning former Justice Dan Kelly in his run for the Supreme Court seat. Joyce Bose is president of the Democratic Party of Grant County, whose members are backing the liberal-leaning Janet Protasiewicz. A week out from Election Day, both acknowledge that the race is not partisan, and it should not be. The judicial system should be part of government people can trust, most because it's just the law, not about the party, Serta said. But anymore, you can't keep the politics out of the judicial system. We should leave the politics to the legislatures. Okay, and two quick news briefs here. In Elkader, Iowa, an asphalt repaving project will cause some lane closures beginning next week on the state highway in Clayton County. The project will impact drivers using Iowa 13 between Elkader and Strawberry Point starting on Monday, the 3rd of April. Drivers will be directed through the work zone with flaggers and pilot cars. The State Department of Transportation also advises increased caution in the area and close adherence to posted speed limits. The work on the project should finish sometime in August. Applications sought for arts and culture grants. The City of Dubuque is accepting applications for its annual Arts and Culture Special Projects Grants. Since 2005, the program annually provides supporting the arts and cultural experiences in Dubuque, according to an online announcement. The grants are allocated in amounts ranging from $1,000 to $8,000 to nonprofit organizations and Dubuque-based groups operating in service to the broader community, but not incorporated as a nonprofit, according to the City of Dubuque's website. An informational webinar about the grants will be held at 2 p.m. on the 7th of April. And here's how you can register. Register at the following, register.gotowebinar.com/register. And here is the number, and I will go through this number very slowly for you. 4 7 1 0 3 5 0 7 7 0 8 5 8 0 9 5 9. It's a pretty long number to add to the email address. Applications are due on the 12th of May and are available online. And you can also visit cityofdubuque.org/2358/special-projects-grants for more information about that. All right. We have approached the first half hour of our broadcast here. I would like to remind you that my name is Peter Welch, and I'm your narrator here today, and I'm reading the Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, the 29th of March, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. We do have some obituary news, so let's read that, and then what we're going to do is we're going to go to the lifestyle part of the paper. Okay, Daryl D. Griffith, age 90, passed away at the Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital in Dubuque. Visitations will be from 9 a.m. until 10:15 a.m. on Saturday, on the 1st of April, at the United Methodist Church, Sherrill, S-H-E-R-R-I-L-L. The funeral service for Daryl will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday on the 1st of April, 2023. At the United Methodist Church, Sherrill, with Reverend Emily Blue officiating. And the burial will be in the church cemetery. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post Number 6 and the Iowa Army National Guard. John R. Homan has passed at the age of 91 of Dubuque. And that was on Saturday, the 25th of March, at his home, surrounded by his loving family. The family will thankfully receive your support through greeting cards and memorials in John's memory, which may be mailed to Behr, that's B-E-H-R, Funeral Home at 1491 Main Street in Dubuque. And that's zip code is 52001. And you can write on that, on the envelope, "Attention John Homan," that's H-O-H-M-A-N-N family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.behrfuneralhome.com. Okay, let's see who else we have here. Susan Romberg, age 81 of Dubuque, passed away at her home. The Mass of Christian Burial for Susan will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 23rd. Excuse me, I should say April 1st, 2023, at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church with Father Brian Dellert as the celebrant. And the burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Visitation will be from 9:30 a.m. till 10:45 a.m. prior to the Mass of St. Joseph's the Worker Catholic Church. Lois Ann Hansen, age 93, passed on the 25th of March at the Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. And a special thank you to the staff at Stonehill's Care Center, Hospice of Dubuque, especially Jeremiah, in lieu of flowers. Memorials have been established for the Alzheimer's Association and Hospice of Dubuque. And also Robert Robinson, age 75 of Dubuque, passed on the 28th of March. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Egelhoff, let me spell that, E-G-E-L-L-H-O-F, comma, S-I-E-G-E-R-T, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory. And they are located at 2659 Kennedy Road, where a funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday. And burial will be in Mount Oliver Cemetery, where military rites will be accorded. All right, let's turn now to lifestyle section of the paper. and it's all about food. And let's see, what have we got here today? Oh boy, fluffy food fight. Oh, good heavens. There's a picture here of this fluffy fruit concoction. It's a salad. And this apparently, this salad, I guess, recipe, or I guess goes back over 100 years. And by the way, it's ambrosia, if it's a dessert. It's ambrosia salad when it takes a prideful spot on the table during the main course. All right, so it says coconut question mark, marshmallows, feelings run hot and debate about how to best prepare this ambrosia salad. Well, in New York, my name's Joyce, drawls a neighbor to Edward Scissorhands, and I notice that you have not tasted any of the ambrosia salad that I made especially for you. Johnny Depp's character in the 1990 cult film opens wide to receive a giant spoonful of the fluffy, pink-tinged fruit confection. He manages an as he chews, but not before viewers are treated to a food, sexy little scene involving Joyce's disembodied hands laboriously preparing the dish, which has a long history and passionate protectors. Mostly a holiday treat from Easter, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, ambrosia of yore was a humble delight, at least when compared to Joyce's version or many of the fluffy parties in fancy bowls seen now on TikTok and Instagram. In 1867, Maria Massey Barringer of Concord, North Carolina, provided a recipe in her Dixie Cookery, or How I Managed My Table for 12 Years. She counseled readers to stick to fresh, grated coconut, sweetened with a little sugar and alternating layers with pulped oranges. Goody's Ladies Book and Magazine, founded in Philadelphia, agreed with Barringer's take on ambrosia in 1879, but offered pineapple as a worthy alternative. Some use both, the magazine noted, but it's better with only one fruit. Joyce's version, on the other hand, is far busier, involving pineapple and peaches, oranges, heavy cream, yogurt, cherry juice, toasted coconut, and chopped pecans. She tops the pile with marshmallows and cherries. Oh, good heavens. Classic ambrosia consists of oranges and coconut, then sugar to taste, says James Beard, James Beard award-winning chef. Virginia Mills in Atlanta, ambrosia isn't retro. Ambrosia has never gone out of fashion in the South. I've probably had ambrosia every year of my 56 years. Aficionados like Willis feel strongly about their ambrosia, sometimes relying on recipes passed down within families for generations. Willis melds her Southern roots and French culinary training in her cookbooks, including Bon Appetit, Y'all. Among her most cherished childhood memories, she said, was my grandfather boring a hole in the coconut and turning it upside down to let the water drip into the glass. Feelings run hot all along the ambrosia spectrum, starting with the name. It's ambrosia if it's a dessert. It's ambrosia salad when it takes a prideful spot on the table during the main course. There are other debates. Coconut. Use it or forget it. Fresh or pre-shredded, toasted or not. Fruit, canned or fresh. One type or several. Drain or use the juices. Maraschino cherries. Dump in wet, risking a pink tinge to the end result. Drain and pat dry. Hard pass altogether. Oh boy. Marshmallows, the big ones or the miniatures. The white ones or the multicolored pastels. Leaving out because they're gag-inducing, whipped cream, ice cream, cheese, sour cream, yogurt, mayo. In Brooklyn, Let's Eat cookbook writer and food influencer Dan Pelosi relied on his Aunt Jessie to lead the way on ambrosia salad. She led him to a vast, more contemporary world of fluff salads made with boxed instant puddings and powdered colored gelatin. And it was Aunt Jessie Pelosi who said she called on her green concoction made with instant pistachio pudding ambrosia salad rather than Watergate salad, as such a thing is more commonly known, because one story goes it rose in popularity during the Watergate scandal of the 1970s. There's so many different ways to do it, Pelosi said, of ambrosia salad. I make it the way that my family made it, which doesn't have marshmallows because we didn't even like them. Ambrosia was so named for the food of the Greek and Roman gods. Its region of origin is lost to history. Its ties to the South are strong, though some believe it began in Vermont or elsewhere in New England. David Shields, a culinary historian, author, and professor of the University of South Carolina and Columbia, has even another theory. Ambrosia starts popping up in newspaper stories on local parties, he said. In the latter 1870s, the earliest of those sorts of stories actually all come from Missouri for some reason. The idea that Missouri is the first hotbed of ambrosia is a kind of odd one, but there are lots of reports on usually all women's celebrations having a supper in which ambrosia and ice cream are being served. The dish can be a gross out for some with its unusual look and texture, but it began as an exotic luxury using hard-to-find ingredients. Shields said that the key to the spread of ambrosia was the invention of a machine to process coconut meat. Fresh oranges, meanwhile, were considered a winter treat until the Orange Belt began mass distribution. It started as one of the Gilded Age dishes, he said. Ambrosia quickly trickled down to the middle classes with the rise of easily obtainable processed coconut and year-round access to oranges and pineapples. Jamie Johnston, who runs the food blog My Baking Addiction, recreated her childhood ambrosia salad for the site. It's loaded with pineapple, mandarin oranges, and coconut, and those bagged miniature fruit-flavored marshmallows. Growing up in Ohio, my Nana often made simple Midwestern fluff salads for holidays, such as Easter and Thanksgiving, said Johnston, who lives in Cleveland. Just one bite can take me right back to Nana's kitchen. Multiple beard winner Natalie Dupree, who has written 14 cookbooks and appeared on numerous food television shows, grew up in Virginia. The 83-year-old's strongest girlhood ambrosia memories are from the fall and winter holidays when it was served as a side dish. We had a relative who just sent us fresh oranges. I did the cutting up. Dupree has included tweaked versions of ambrosia in some of her books, including one with coconut, cherries, and bananas. For her own table, she has added pecans, but never a binder. It's binders, whipped cream, etc., that rankle the old guard. Shield sees original ambrosia without a binder or a riot of ingredients. As the gold standard, there's a simplicity to it that's just so elegant. Well, that's quite some article, isn't it? All right, what else do we have here? Oh, my goodness. This one is a one-minute garlic pan sauce transforms spicy chicken tray bake. All right. And there's a picture of it here, chicken a la Diavola, that's D-I-A-V-O-L-A, is a one-pan tray bake that is ready, in less than an hour. So let's take a look at this. This is written by Christopher Kimball. When you're roasting food, air circulation is everything. That's why we prefer low-rimmed baking sheets over roasting pans. They accelerate cooking and boost browning in our weeknight tray bakes. But in some instances, a bit of crowding on the pan can be beneficial, such as in the spicy chicken a la Diavolo. That's Diavolo. I know I didn't pronounce that correctly. From our book, Tuesday Night's Mediterranean, which features weeknight-friendly meals from the region. After tossing bone-in, skin-on chicken parts with ample red pepper flakes and thyme, we arrange the meat in a circle around 8 whole peeled garlic cloves. The chicken roasts in a 475-degree oven until deeply browned, but the cloves in the center are protected from scorching in the high heat. Instead, they soften and sweeten, perfect for mashing into a paste to mix with the chicken's juices for a savory sauce that is ready in just a minute. Mixing lemon zest and pepperoncini into the sauce gives it an extra kick. Adding broccoli to the pan makes it complete one-pan dinner that comes together in well under 1 hour. Just be careful not to cut the broccoli pieces too small. Keeping them in larger 3-inch pieces prevents them from overcooking. And use only the broccoli crowns, not the lower parts of the stems. The crowns don't require peeling and are quick and easy to prep. All right, now, how are we going to make this thing? First, you've got to get, from start to finish, it's about 45 minutes to prepare. And this is for 4 people. So I hope you got your pen and paper here. Here we go. 1 tablespoon of dried thyme, 1 1/4 teaspoons of red pepper flakes, kosher salt and ground black pepper, 4 12-ounce bone-in, skin-on chicken breasts, or 3 pounds bone-in, skin-on chicken thighs, trimmed and patted dry, 1/4 cup plus 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil divided, 2 pounds of broccoli crowns cut into 3-inch florets, 8 medium garlic cloves peeled, 1 tablespoon of grated lemon zest plus lemon wedges to serve, 1/2 cup of chopped drained pepperoncini, that's P-E-P-E-R-O-N-C-I-N-I, 1/4 cup of lightly packed fresh oregano chopped, and then it's ready to be put into the oven at a temperature of 475 degrees with a rack in the middle position. In a large bowl, stir together the thyme and the pepper flakes and 2 teaspoons each salt and pepper. Sprinkle 2 tablespoons of the mix onto all sides of the chicken. To the remaining seasoning mix in the bowl, add the 1/4 cup of oil and the broccoli, then toss to coat. Place the garlic in the center of a rimmed baking sheet. Then arrange the chicken. Skin up around the garlic. This placement helps prevent the garlic from scorching during roasting. Arrange the broccoli in an even layer around the chicken. Roast until the thickest part of the breasts, if using, reaches to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, and the thickest part of the thighs, if that's what you're using, reaches 175 degrees Fahrenheit, about 30 minutes. Using tongs, transfer the chicken and the broccoli to a serving platter. Transfer the garlic to a medium bowl, and using a fork, mash it to a rough paste. Carefully pour 1/4 cup of water onto the baking sheet and scrape up any browned bits and pour the pan juices over the garlic. And then add the lemon zest and the pepperoncini. Then whisk in the remaining 2 tablespoons of oil. Taste and seasons with salt and pepper. Pour the sauce over the chicken and the broccoli. Then sprinkle with oregano. And then serve with lemon wedges. Oh, you know, I love reading this, but on the other hand, I don't, because every time I do, I get hungry. All right, let's keep moving here. All right, we're going to talk to, or we should see here, Dr. Michael Rosen, who I read every week here, Roizen, R-O-I-Z-E-N, take importance of sleep to heart. Super busy superstars, Rihanna, J-Lo, and Mariah Carey have all admitted to being so wound up by their nonstop schedules and ambitions that they got very little sleep for years. Now they say they've changed their ways. Well, I hope so. A new study shows that insomnia and sleep deprivation, getting 5 or fewer hours of sleep nightly, increases the risk of having a heart attack by 69%. What's the cause? Studies in the lab show that the chronic stress and increased levels of the stress hormone cortisol speed up damage to blood vessels, increasing the risk of a heart attack. Plus, when a person has diabetes and insomnia, the risk is even greater. And it's estimated that 50% of the folks with diabetes contend with insomnia and other sleep issues fueled by fluctuations in blood glucose levels. So if you're concerned about your health, your heart health, and you should be, since 77.5% of men and 75.4% of women ages 60 to 79 have some form of cardiovascular disease. According to the American Heart Association, improving your sleeping habits should be right up there with managing stress, eating a plant-based diet, getting 300 minutes of physical activity a week. For chronic insomnia, smart step number one is to sleep specialists who can explore your habits, uncover the cause of your sleep problems, and make sure to practice stress management. Maintain a regular to bed time in dark, cool rooms with no digital devices and eat a lighter meal for dinner no later than 7 p.m. Well, that's certainly good advice. I think that our country as a whole, there's a lot of sleep deprivation there. It's unfortunately too common. And so he has good advice there. Okay, let's see what else is going on here today in the paper. Hy-Vee recalls boxed meal due to undeclared allergen. A regional grocery chain is recalling a boxed meal sold at its stores. Hy-Vee is voluntarily recalling its Hy-Vee chili macaroni hamburger skillet meal because of the presence of an undeclared allergen that is not listed on product packaging, according to a press release. The release states that Hy-Vee was alerted to the undeclared allergen on Friday. There have been no reports of any adverse reactions, though. The recalled producer, or product, I should say, has a UPC of following number: 00754500855520, and a lot number of February 8th, 2024 Y18, and was distributed to Hy-Vee and Dollar Fresh Market stores in 8 states, including Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. So customers who purchase the item have a dairy sensitivity should just throw it away or return it to the store for a refund. And your telephone number to Hy-Vee is 800-772-4098 for more information on that. All right. We've got just a couple minutes left here. Let's take a quick look at U.S.-Russian stop sharing nuke data. In Washington, the U.S. and Russia have stopped sharing biannual nuclear weapon data under the New START Treaty, the last arms control pact between the two countries, U.S. officials said on Tuesday. Officials at the White House and Pentagon and State Department said that the U.S. had offered to continue providing this information to Russia even after President Vladimir Putin suspended Russia's participation in the treaty last month. But Moscow informed Washington that it would not be sharing its own data. Because of Russia's non-compliance with these obligations under the treaty, the United States will not provide its biannual data exchange to Russia either, in order to encourage Russia to return to compliance with the treaty, State Department spokesman Vedant Patel told reporters. The White House, which has previously accused Russia of multiple violations of the treaty, has said that Russia's refusal to comply is legally invalid, and the decisions to withhold the nuclear data is yet another violation. despite being extended shortly after President Joe Biden took office in January of 2021. New START, that's S-T-A-R-T, talks, have been severely tested by Russia's war in Ukraine and has been on its life support for more than a month since Putin announced Russia would no longer comply with its requirements. And that just about does it here for the reading of the Telegraph Herald here today for Wednesday, March 29th. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the IRO Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. I want to say thank you very much for listening, and we will talk again. Bye-bye now, everybody.